Support for NPR and the following message come from our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. Having a party? Whatever you're celebrating, Whole Foods Market has everything you need for a spectacular event. Premium meats, prepared foods, desserts, and more. Start every celebration at Whole Foods Market.
The movie All of Us Strangers is a wistful fantasy drama that tells two intersecting stories about different kinds of love. One between a son and his long-deceased parents, the other of two lonely men and neighbors who long for connection.
At the center of it all is Andrew Scott, playing a man struggling to reconcile his traumatic past with his isolated present. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Aisha Harris, and today we're talking about All of Us Strangers on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the official Hacks podcast from Max. Join the creators and showrunners of Hacks as they discuss each episode and speak with the cast and crew about the making of the series. Listen to the official Hacks podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Third Love. Third Love makes solutions for every bra problem. Give yourself more lift, smoothing, and get straps that stay put. Every style's wear-tested on real women, made from premium materials, with a virtual fitting room to help you find your perfect fit. Comfort and support are guaranteed. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with code PODCAST15. Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation.
Joining us today is NPR senior editor Bilal Qureshi. Hey, Bilal.
Hi, Aisha, and hi, Glenn.
Welcome back.
Hey.
All of Us Strangers stars Andrew Scott as Adam, a TV writer living a lonely existence in London. No social circle, no family to speak of. The only other resident in his large apartment complex is Harry, played by Paul Mescal. And one evening, Harry knocks on Adam's door, introduces himself, and the two begin an intense romance. Meanwhile, Adam begins confronting his past. He returns to his childhood home and has regular visits with the ghosts of his parents, who died in a car crash when he was 12 years old. They're played by Claire Foy and Jamie Bell, and they look and remind Adam exactly of how they were when they died. In their conversations, he attempts to finally process the loss of mom and dad and how it's impacted his ability to have meaningful relationships in his adult life. It's directed by Andrew Hay, who's no stranger to tales of intimate and complex relationships. His previous films include Weekend and 45 Years. All of Us Strangers is in theaters now. So, Glenn, I want to start with you. Mm-hmm. First of all, I found it fascinating to read about this after the fact, because Andrew Hay, he considers this movie to be very personal. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the scenes where Adam's going back to his childhood home were shot in Hay's own childhood home, which he hadn't visited in like 4+ decades. You know, while watching this, did it come across to you as something that was deeply personal? Or in other words, like, did Adam's journey feel true to you in a way?
Oh, it did. This is such a warm and sincere film. Open. It's a very open film that it does feel very personal. And I also feel, just stating out here at the front, that it feels like expressing anything less than fulsome praise for this thing feels like I'm kicking a puppy.
Oh.
And I don't mean to. Like, I do admire this. I think this is incredibly well wrought. But yeah. I was kind of cool to it. I always try to say, it's not sentiment in film that I object to, in comedy and drama, in fiction, because sentiment is just real emotion, and that's necessary. What gives me hives is sentimentality, which is reaching for real sentiment, reaching for real emotion and failing to find it, so you bust out all these tricks. And I want to be clear, that doesn't happen here. I think this film, up to its closing minutes, which is where it kind of lost me, has the restraint and the specificity that have made me an Andrew Hay superfan.
Yeah.
You got a placid surface, you got roiling emotions underneath, and the tension of keeping them in check just so you can get through the damn day. That's what it's all about. And Andrew Hay has his detractors who call his films inert and slow and nothing happens. They're missing that energy, that drama. Yeah. That's what I love. I think this, as I say, it's exquisitely made. Andrew Scott, if you only know him as Moriarty from Sherlock or even Sexy Priest from Fleabag.
Hot Priest, yes.
He is so much more inward and hooded here than you might expect. I don't want to sleep on Claire Foy. I do want to get to the structure of this, which is where it lost me, but I want to hear what you guys think of it first.
Yeah, Bilal, like, how did it resonate for you?
I agree with what Glenn was saying in that, you know, I'm also an Andrew Hay super fan, and I think the few films he's made, he has not made that many, they're all incredibly impactful and stay with you, and I think his films have a way of lingering long after, and I saw this, and I have not been able to fully shake kind of what its effect was. And I even find myself, like you were saying, Glenn, you know, wrestling with kind of how I actually feel about it. But I will say that to the people who think his films can be inert and sort of slow, this does feel like his biggest film in a way to me because it's so lush. I just want to point out that from the first frames where like the light is coming into this apartment building where Andrew Scott's character lives alone, there's a lot of kind of play with light and sort of dawn and dusk and sort of loneliness and the music in it. And there's a lot of incredible songs in it because he's reckoning with his past and his 80s childhood, the Pet Shop Boys and songs from the kind of 80s English youth. So that all stuff feels very personal. And of course, like it's a foursome cast that's just incredible of, you know, thespians. The kind of, you know, the elegance of it and the bigness of it and all of those same emotional concerns, all of that was there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very odd film in a lot of ways because it is doing both a ghost story and a kind of gay coming of age story. And there's a lot it's trying to reconcile, which I also don't know if it entirely achieves. But I'm kind of with you, Glenn, on sort of, I don't want to kick the puppy either because it's a very elegant one.
Yeah, I kind of see where you both are coming from. I think I was hotter on it than you were. It's still lingering with me. And I think about the fact that at this point, we have seen quite a few sort of white, gay, male love stories in films. And part of me is like, oh, okay, can we have more different kinds of gay and queer love stories and complicated feelings? And also just stories about coming out and of wrestling with having a traumatic childhood. Mm-hmm. But then when we have this story being told in this way, Glenn, you hinted at the structure not quite working for you. I don't know if it was a structure for you or if it was maybe the aesthetics, because the movie kind of reveals itself as it goes along and takes its time to reveal. Like when we first come across his parents, if you don't know anything about like going into this, what this is actually about, because I didn't know anything about it. So at first when he sees a man and he starts following him, I'm like, oh, okay, what's happening here? And then he goes to the house and then they start talking. And I'm like, oh, he's talking to his parents who are his age, but like they're dead. So it's very piecemeal in a way. But I think for me, that's what kept me intrigued. That's what kept me engrossed in the story. And when you have that with the Paul Mescal character and their love story, I was into it. And by the end of it, I felt like I had just gone on this journey. And it really just made me think a lot about the ways that you can tell similar stories that have been told before, but tell them in new and different ways. Mm-hmm. But I want to pose this question to you because I think there's this sort of subtle generational divide.
Yeah.
It's subtle when it comes to the Harry and Adam character, because Harry seems to be way more, he's just like, I'm younger and I don't have all these hangups about, you know, being gay at, like you do. But then you have the generational divide that actually does come up between Adam and his parents. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious like how that played for you.
Well, this film to me is being marketed as the Andrew Scott, Paul Mescal gay romance film. I think that's maybe 2/5 of what's going on here. It's 3/5 his stuff with the parents. And the how and why, the setup of this film is supernatural. He's talking to his dead parents.
Yeah.
But the what of it is universal and familiar. It's just, he's talking to his parents. So that first visit, like any parental visit, are golden, pristine. It's a love fest.
Mm.
And after that, if you stay a little bit longer, they start to revert to the flawed people they are, shaped by their experiences and kind of hemmed in by their history. And they start saying thoughtless things and hurtful things and resentful things because, of course, they do because they're human. But what happens there is your idealized memory of them meets the real people they are.
Yeah.
And that's what those subsequent visits are about. And that's what I think is the heart of this thing, more than the romance. The thing I was interested in was this relationship with the parents. And for a while, those subsequent visits get more complicated, more tense, more kind of weighted with this unspoken conflict. But subsequently, that dramatic tension starts to slacken, and suddenly those conversations with his parents devolve and flatten and become therapy sessions. Mm. But I was watching these characters grow less real and less specific. And in the final moments of this film, which are a big swing.
Very big swing.
I'm fine with that because there are a hell of a lot of people for whom that ending will work completely.
I think the more we've kind of talked about this, and I have to kind of, I think, be a lot more honest about the fact that I think what I'm struggling with is this film made me extremely sad. In a way, yeah, to your point earlier, Glenn, about the way it's been marketed, it's this sort of image of Paul Mescal mm-hmm. having his hand around Andrew Scott and like, mm-hmm. you know, these are the kind of zeitgeist actors. Instead, it sort of hit at like the core, I would say, for a certain generation, clearly, like gay trauma of like loneliness, the life not lived, the parents you didn't get to have the conversation with, the like trauma of the closet. I mean, psychology shelves of gay bookstores are filled with these sorts of things. And I did find myself wondering about how painful and kind of how difficult it is, especially in the context of like the kind of things we're talking about wanting to see more of from queer stories and gay stories. And then I saw this just like lastly of why maybe it's a little bit depressing is I saw it in the kind of wave of having watched a little bit of Fellow Travelers, which I know, Glenn, you've written about and talked about, and Maestro, which also has this sort of theme of like gay men looking backward at the like things they didn't get to do. And I do think it is the sort of original wound for certain generation and certain gay men. And I think it can be like really hard to be so effectively and so emotionally and so cinematically put right back into it. And I think I haven't quite fully reconciled how I feel about living in that world.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. I mean, this is a very personal sort of like feeling about it.
Yeah, no, I think that absolutely makes sense. And I can understand that sadness and also like maybe that sense of fatigue is maybe you're also feeling in a way of just like more trauma. I think that that's such a valid response. And I do wonder like if because I don't have that, like it was sad to me, like this movie was utterly depressing, but it does not obviously hit me in the same way that it might hit, you know, someone who actually lived the experience that Adam has gone through. I think one of the things that spoke to me the most about this film was something that felt universal feelings that people can have towards their parents, whatever kind of relationship they've had, if it's been very complicated for reasons that maybe don't necessarily involve being queer. There's a scene where he talks to his father and his father admits that he heard him crying in his bedroom when he was younger for being bullied. And, you know, he asks him, like, why didn't you come in and comfort me? And I think, like, to me, that was kind of a punch in the gut of, like, oh, my goodness. Like, I understand this, like, sense of feeling like your parents didn't do more to protect you when you needed them the most. And I don't know, that just really struck me. But I can also just, to your point, well, I'll understand how that can be even more traumatic if that's something you feel so deeply.
And I would say that, like, that is for me the thing that's the strongest of the film that I really loved. And I think what you said is so true. It's like the idea of being able to have the conversation with your parents that you couldn't have. In this case, they've died. And that's the dramatic sort of conceit of the film. But, you know, it also made me think about, to reference a gay film of recent years, Call Me By Your Name, when Timothée Chalamet's character has the conversation with his dad that I think a lot of people, like, loved because it was sort of the conversation they wish they could have had with their dad. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that's a very universal thing. Many people, we've all kind of, you know, read The Body Keeps the Score and all the ways trauma goes generationally through your life. And I think a lot of it rooted in parents and parent relationships. And I think that is a beautifully rendered thing. And there are really long and like incredibly acted scenes of Andrew Scott with his parents who are of the same age in the way that they are in the film. But you're really seeing that conversation that I think a lot of people maybe wish they could have had with their parents. And I think that part of the film is incredible.
Right. Absolutely. And there's a context to the Mescal and Scott relationship, too, which is he's older. Scott is older. There is a mentor aspect to this relationship. And the Scott character didn't have that because the generation above him was wiped out.
Yeah.
So instead, he is talking to his parents, who are more or less the same age as he is, which is a complicated thing. And there's certain moments, the first time you see the father, it could be a hookup. or it could be something else. Yeah. And so all of that is threaded together in a way that adds layers to this thing. I'm not sure it needs to be picked apart, and I don't think it's a particularly schematic film, but I expected it to be. So I went into this movie with the wrong side of my brain. I was trying to figure out the twist, the secret, the gimmick. And whenever you go into a movie with that mode, you are not in the movie, and you're outside of it. You're parsing every bit of dialogue. Is this a possible clue? And then you're thinking to yourself, you're taking yourself further down that road saying, well, if that is a clue to what's really going on, then that's way too on the nose. Which, for the record, I mean, I was right, and some of that dialogue is way too on the nose, but I did not get the experience of this film that I should have, and that's on me.
Well, look, we've all been there. I've definitely been there, and I think, again, the reason it might have worked on me is because, A, I went into it not knowing anything about what it was, what it was, except that, you know, Paul Mescal and Andrew Scott were in it, and I was just kind of able to sort of let myself get swept away, and I was definitely questioning, like, where are we going here? And then at one point I wrote in my notes, like, is this what I think it is? And then when it ended, I was like, oh, yeah, it kind of is. But also, oh my God, why am I sobbing?
Yeah.
I was a little teary-eyed, and the way that this, you mentioned earlier, Bilal, the music, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which is like a group I know vaguely.
You know the one song.
Relax? Is that, did they do Relax? One. Yeah. Yeah, I know that one song, but I did not know The Power of Love somehow. And the way that is employed in this film, oh my God, I went back and it now added it to my playlist on Spotify. And I was like, oh man, this song gets me in the feels. And
yep, it does.
I think another thing I was going to say on that note, that this movie reminded me a bit of Steve McQueen's Shame as well, like the kind of loneliness of like urban life. And there's a lot of the moving between his apartment to where his parents' home is on these trains and like the shadows from the city.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that urban loneliness and melancholy that I think also is very universal if you live in a city. And I think it was a particularly kind of poetic and sort of also sad in a kind of beautiful sad way about that sort of urban, I think, ennui. It is definitely a mood. It's a feel. And I think, yeah, this was like really, truly very emotional. And I feel like it led with that.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, Bilal, one of the things I noticed is that this is supposed to be set in London, but like you never actually feel like you're in London. So... well, we want to know what you think about All of Us Strangers. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. And that brings us to the end of our show. Bilal Qureshi, Glenn Weldon, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Ramel Wood and edited by Jessica Reedy and Mike Katziff. Hello, Come In provides our theme music. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Aisha Harris, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
The economy right now is bewildering, impenetrable, inconceivable.
Not when you have the Indicator podcast in your ears. In under 10 minutes every day, we simplify the complicated news, like...
how does inflation drop? What the heck is a SPAC? Why are trendy little high-fiber sodas suddenly dominating store shelves?
And more. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money and NPR.